A new book examines the role of automobiles in imposing colonialism on Indigenous people and communities. The work is based on extensive research of First Nations people and communities around the world and explores how Indigenous people are often disproportionately criminalised for non-compliance with vehicle regulations, the vehicle as a tool of racial violence, and how Indigenous communities use vehicles for protection, cultural expression, and reconnection with their land. It's a fascinating subject and a comprehensive body of work. Juanita Sherwood is the Professor of Australian Indigenous Education at the University of Technology, Sydney. Her expertise ranges across Indigenous research, First Nations health, cultural safety, birthing on country, and Aboriginal women's incarceration. Thalia Anthony is a Professor of Law at the University of Technology, Sydney. Her work has focused heavily on the legacy of colonisation and systemic racism in legal institutions. Thalia and Juanita, welcome back to Speaking Out.
Thank you.
Well, we're here to talk about a new book that you've co-authored, Unsettling Colonial Automobility's Criminalisation and Contested Sovereignties. It does sound very academic in the title. So, Thalia, I wonder if you could start by giving us a bit of an overview about what the concept of colonial automobilities is.
Yeah, I might just tell you how it started. And Larissa, you'll know about this. Like, at the time of the intervention, I was doing some work up at La Jimanu, and there was this sense with the intervention that they were going to go and find all this crime about Aboriginal child abuse and family violence. And I was sitting in the court just on when I had some time off looking at the stolen wages issue and just noticing the criminalisation of Aboriginal drivers. It was like they wanted to control Aboriginal people's movement. They wanted to let them know that the police would not enable them to be free in Aboriginal communities. And this idea of the automobile being controlled was really quite fascinating to me because I'm in La Jimanu looking at the criminalisation of Aboriginal drivers in their car, and I'm also looking at night patrols, this kind of manifestation of sovereignty and self-determination, Aboriginal people using their vehicles for strength in community. And so I was like, this idea that we criminalise Aboriginal people in their car is part of the colonial system. You know, you can't drive and be free as an Aboriginal person. And then, and Juanita might talk more about this, cars are also colonial because the police use cars to chase Aboriginal people. And so, again, you know, you can't be free. It's like wherever you are, it's a moving checkpoint. And that's why we see the car and colonisation is built into the same framework.
I have to say that when I saw the title, I thought, wow, what's this about? But as you break it down, just as you've done it, it actually becomes a very coherent argument. And I want to get into some of those particular issues that you have addressed there in a bit more detail to reflect some of the things you discuss in the book. But just before we do, Juanita, I wonder if you could also talk about what your motivation was to undertake this body of work and your experiences that led you to want to write in this space.
Well, I think, you know, a very lived experience, really, of observing the way police have interacted with our communities in Redfern, in Alice Springs, in far north Queensland, in Broken Hill. I've lived in all of those places and I've witnessed the criminalisation of our people around fines, broken windows, you know, having a windscreen was cracked for ridiculous reasons and people being fined and then incarcerated. And I've done a lot of work with women who've been incarcerated over the last 15 years. And I just think the criminalisation of our people and how, exactly as Thalia said, the intervention just even further exacerbated the belief that police could control all of us in all ways, on all things. And the criminality of that space, you know, flipping it, it's really critical to look at and examine that space. And I guess my just remembering, you know, my first day in Alice Springs as I moved up there, I witnessed a big white Jeep trying to run down an Aboriginal family at the Kmart car park. And I just went, oh, my God, what have I come to? And, you know, that was after my days of working in, you know, in Redfern on Everleigh Street. So yes, I was very driven and pulled to work in this space.
Thalia, you mentioned that one of the sparks for the idea in this space was sitting in a court and watching that criminalisation of drivers. I wonder if you can explain in a little bit more detail for people who would have no idea what it's like in those courtrooms, what you were seeing and how people are criminalised as drivers in that process.
Yeah, so people who are driving in community are really low-hanging fruit for the police. They can pull over someone, as they routinely do, and charge them for a huge range of things. It might be something like a defected vehicle, because so many of the vehicles sold in communities are sold in a really shoddy way by dodgy dealers coming into communities and ripping them off. It could be an unregistered vehicle because there's no mechanics in communities to actually provide registration slips, and then there's no registration services. It could be unlicensed driving. It could be uninsured vehicle. There's all these things, and police, rather than saying, okay, how do we, you know, provide licensing, or how do we actually ensure that there's a registration process, they simply put on a fine, they disqualify the driver and set them up into this cycle where they can never drive lawfully. And so you have them piling people into the criminal courts, the bush courts, and they feel that there's this pressure to just plead guilty to get it over and done with. And that might be okay the first, second, third time, but like Juanita said, eventually we have people sitting in prison because they don't have access to services for their vehicle. They can't afford to get, you know, well-maintained vehicles and buy vehicles that are from reputable salespeople. And they're penalised by being in prison. So when we were looking at the proportion of people in prison in the Northern Territory a few years ago, it was 25% of people, one quarter of people in prison. So 90% of people in Northern Territory prisons are Aboriginal because of the systemic racism there. And a quarter of those are there for driving. And it's all just so unnecessary. And it has huge consequences for community. You know, they're taken, the only prisons in the Northern Territory are Darwin and Alice Springs. They're taken out of their remote communities. They can't care for their kids. They can't learn culture. They can't pass on culture. So it's not only stopping them from driving, it's stopping them from being part of the continuation of their community and culture.
Juanita, another issue that you look at in the book is the issue of missing Aboriginal women and girls. Can you talk a bit about why that was a topic that made its way into the book?
Because, I mean, this is an area that has been talked about in Canada. It's also been talked about in New Zealand. And, you know, it's definitely an issue here and it's hidden. And this book, if anything, is trying to demonstrate and be a truth teller around what is going on to our women in Australia. As First Nation women, they're treated appallingly. We know, again, through the intervention, you know, our young women were targeted by truck drivers, etc., in a whole lot of unhealthy, or you know, approaches to their sexuality, etc. And I think we have many, many women who have been killed and murdered in this space that we don't have their bodies to show those spaces.
Yeah, and I think what happens, and this is for men as well, that there's a lot of deaths on highways, yeah. You know, where it's, you know, remote part of the country, there's no accountability. Invariably, it's a racialised, sexualised issue that targets First Nations women, but we've also had other cases of missing First Nations young men. So I think that what happens is that these lands that were once, including highways along the song lines of Aboriginal people, they're appropriated, you know, by colonisers and turned into highways that then make this space where they were once empowered a space where they're incredibly vulnerable. and where the legal system doesn't properly investigate to provide justice for these families. And that's why we've got, you know, inquiries today where we're still looking for answers for First Nations people whose lives were taken decades ago on highways.
You both touched on this role that police cars play in the death of First Nations people when you were talking about why you were drawn to writing in this space and wanting to explore the issues. Thalia, can you give us some more examples of the kind of instances you look at?
Yeah, and the police chase is an ongoing issue. We've just had the death of Jai Wright referred to the DPP, and that was also a police chase a couple of years ago. So even though we give some examples that are a bit more historical, and we start with TJ Hickey, who was killed in Redfern in 2004, it's a police chase where not only was there huge tragic injustice in how he was killed, which was impaled outside a housing commission estate in Waterloo, but it was also a case of tragic injustice in what followed. And the officers responsible never gave evidence. The bike that TJ was riding in the chase was never presented to the coroner. No one knows what happened to it. And we've just had the 20th anniversary of TJ's passing, and still the family do not have any answers of what happened. They also can't even have an official plaque where he died, because the police don't want to take responsibility. And I think this idea that, which is part of why we wrote the book, that, you know, police chases are just a normal part of police duties. And even the Royal Commission in 1991 into Aboriginal deaths in custody didn't examine the police chase. That since then we do count deaths in police chase in official statistics. But it's only recently that we've started to say, no, it's not routine police activity. It's actually a deadly chase that is targeted at First Nations people. And then more recently, we have the case of Raymond Knoll in Victoria, where the police targeted him, which is so common, for driving a dodgy car. And immediately they put on the sirens. They're driving at 134 kilometres an hour, and within seconds he's dead. And I feel like, you know, the way the coroners respond is the car got out of control, as if it's a mistake rather than... I mean, this is the trap. You know, First Nations people are either targeted for driving dodgy cars, or they're targeted because their cars look too good. It's like there's no way you can win in this colonial system. And I feel like this is the, you know, this is the racism embedded in, you know, the policing of First Nations drivers.
Juanita, you also mentioned when we were talking about what drew you to this topic that while there is a whole section in the book where you look at the role of policing and police cars, that actually non-Indigenous drivers are also part of this equation.
Yes.
Can you give us a bit of an overview about some of the issues you look at there?
Basically, non-Indigenous people feel that they have the authority, like the police, you know, that they can take up and imprison and penalise and injure our people. And there is this ongoing colonial way of doing business. And I just couldn't believe what I saw this morning. I went, oh, my goodness, what are we? What year are we living in? 2024, and we've got these non-Indigenous people thinking that they can take up their own power and enact it against our people. And that power is, you know, with... We talk about a Kumanjay rider who was killed in Alice Springs in the riverbank, chased down by five non-Aboriginal men who felt it necessary to teach him a lesson and kill him, and evaded being support, you know, evaded paying any retribution for that. And their imprisonment was minimal. And having lived in the territory, that I saw the belief system and of this is okay, you know, and because people are not charged and are not criminalised, people feel they can get away with this.
Thalia, it becomes apparent looking at this space that there is a situation that we see in other aspects of the criminal justice system where you see First Nations people overrepresented as victims of crime, but also over-policed for minor offences. What are your observations about that in this space?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of your work represents this as well, Larissa. This idea that, you know, they're so heavily policed when the police want to punish them, when they want to control their lives, the new Aboriginal protectors. And yet when a First Nations person dies on the roads at the hands of either, you know, a white settler or the police, the investigations are really inadequate. There's absolutely racism in both the investigations and the prosecutions. I think that with the Aboriginal people who die as pedestrians, the attitude at least, and I've been on Talkback Radio in Darwin, the attitude of the people calling in is that they're the problem. They're putting themselves in a dangerous situation. And like Juanita was saying, and we saw this also with Elijah Doherty in Kalgoorlie, when, you know, in the very rare instance that a settler or a police officer is charged, what happens is that the sentencing is so sympathetic with the offender. So if you look at the sentencing remarks for Elijah Doherty's perpetrator, he's seen as a good guy who had a good job, who had a family and responsibilities. There's nothing in those sentencing remarks that really paint a picture of Elijah and his important role in his family, his culture and his community. And I think the failure of the legal system to humanise Aboriginal people, including those who die on the roads, and in Elijah's case, I'd say it was a very calculated killing. Their lives are just are diminished to really give justice to the harmfulness of the crime.
Juanita, what are you hoping that the impact of this book will be? And in particular, I'm interested in what sort of legal and policy reforms you'd like to see.
I think really it's a truth-telling. And, you know, we need to be more involved in the truth-telling of what's going on today. And this book bears witness to a lot of really important stories, and it contextualises those stories very well. And I think it's about providing evidence that this is not nonsense. This is not, you know, myth-making. It's backed up with a great deal of evidence. And, you know, after the referendum of last year, where we had a lot of people creating a lot of myths, we've come out with a text that is, you know, the truth. And it is vital. It is a vital component to what where we are seeing the criminal justice system work around our community. And for our youth in particular, a big concern of mine is that their experiences in the justice system undermine their opportunities to ever be educated. You know, they are put into a system where, you know, the education is not even considered, and they're missing out on being, you know, able to capture what every other child in this country has laid out for them. And I feel that that criminalisation is just further impoverishment of our people. And when they are in the system, the poor treatment continues. So I want to see improved. I'd like to see that our people don't go to prison for car fines, etc. And also, there should be funding made available for our communities to access driving tests and get regos, etc. New Zealand's doing a lot of really good work like this in North and South Island, and there's an opportunity for us to likewise do similar programs. And because driving a car can provide a really good income to a family and a community, so we could flip this and make driving and the use of cars and our community love cars to build further opportunities for employment, etc.
And what about you, Thalia? Are there particular reforms and impacts you'd like to see as a result of this work?
Yeah, I mean, the listeners here can't see the cover of the book, but the cover is quite graphic. It's a police car burning. It's a mural that Scott Marsh produced in COVID following the killing of George Floyd, which then reinvigorated calls by First Nations people for justice. And one of those calls was from TJ's family. So he did a burning police car to illustrate the resistance against the police and their imposition on First Nations people on the roads, especially poor young TJ. And I think that's what I would want to see, less targeting of police cars of Aboriginal mob. I'd like to see more strength and empowerment for night patrols in Aboriginal communities and let community take care of their own safety, because their safety would look a lot better than guns and police in community. And I think if we take away the police vehicle, we're taking away a lot of the power of the police to follow and chase Aboriginal people and mobs. So I'm not saying that this is just about changing, say, the colonial legal system. I think it's also about shifting our focus to how the vehicle can be used to protect mob and to, when Anita said, to further opportunities and to further their capacity to even do things like use the vehicle to freely go out on country, you know, to take kids on country and do stuff that really reconnects them with country rather than, you know, vehicles being used to incarcerate mob.
Another issue that you've both worked on that I just wanted to pick up on is the transition of First Nations women from prison. Juanita, you did mention that when you were talking about your work background and some of the things that you've focused on in the past, but you've both worked in this space. Yeah. And I wondered, Juanita, if you could just tell us some of the issues that you see facing First Nations women when they are released back into the community.
Interestingly, yes, I can definitely talk to this. And I'm currently on a project called Bangamalana, and I've been interviewing women who've been in prison and exiting prison around. They get no healthcare provision inside. Ideally, it's believed that they're looked after from a health perspective, but that's, you know, they can wait 2 months to see someone in the health workforce in prison. And generally, people get put on a lot of medication to calm people down. And I spoke to a young woman who put on 42 kilos in 2 years during her imprisonment because of the dodgy food that people get fed. And we know diabetes is, you know, a critical issue in our communities. And in fact, prison diet and lack of health provision creates that. And women leaving prison and men are at really high risk of committing crimes within the first week. They're released without any money. They're released without clean clothes. They may have an outfit organised for them through Dressed for Success. But for a lot of people who have been on remand, that doesn't happen. And if they've got soiled clothes, they just have to walk out in the greens. There's no housing support. There's no referrals for medical health. And I'm really worried about that because a lot of people get put on, as they should, a medication for mental health issues. And when you're released, you're given maybe 4 or 5 days worth of medication. It can take 2 months, 3 months to get in to see a medical psychiatric being to provide you with another script. So what do you do in the meantime? These people are put at greater risk, if anything. So we're doing a double injury and double harm to people being released into a community that has no housing support for them. And we know the housing's a big issue for everybody, but, you know, triply for our men and women leaving the prison. And generally, they have no options for, you know, finding a place to live and build up their ability to be recognised as a good tenant, etc. They've probably been thrown into prison without being able to tell housing that that's what's happened. And so they've got a bad reference around them. So there's just so much that damage that occurs just by being put in prison for a month or two.
And Thalia, from your perspective, you worked in this space too. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so when we spoke with Aboriginal women in prison, one of the stories that really stood out was at a prison down on the south coast where an Aboriginal mother was driving her child who had high needs and was going to an appointment for a disability service, and she got pulled up by the police. She was charged with driving-related offences relating to registration and licensing. She's then arrested, denied bail. When I saw her, she'd been inside for 4 months, still waiting for a hearing, and her children had been taken into care. Mm. So she, in that time, had lost her home, lost her job, lost her freedom, and lost her children, all because of driving charges. And I really was confronted by that. I asked her, how do you keep going? Like, it's too much. It's too unfair. And her response was the only thing giving her strength with the other Aboriginal women in prison. I still feel really emotional because frivolous it is to put Aboriginal women in prison who have so many important roles in order to deal with a problem that is one of servicing and poverty. If women had access to proper vehicles, to, proper services, there would be an ability for them to drive lawfully. But the system sets them up that it's almost impossible for them to comply with all these rules. And rather than assist them, they're criminalised and they lose so much in that process. So what we really suggest in the book is that there are better ways to do this. And part of the amazing initiatives include, like out at Yuendumu, where the Aboriginal community set up a mechanic and they have the children doing mechanic apprentices at Mount Theo. So there's ways in which Aboriginal people can and have been empowered to drive in a way that is lawful and safe, but the system just deals with them through a way that creates more harm and doesn't address the problem, which is one of, I think, Aboriginal people not having the capacity to freely move on their country.
Well, thank you so much for all the work you've done in this really interesting and complex space. And thank you so much, both of you, for taking the time to stop by, speaking out and talk about it.
Thank you very much for having us.
That's Professor of Law at the University of Technology, Sydney, Thalia Anthony, and Juanita Sherwood, who is Professor of Indigenous Education at the Jumbana Institute at the University of Technology, Sydney. Their new book, Unsettling Colonial Automobilities, Criminalisation and Contested Sovereignties, is available now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.